Assalamu alaikum students. On behalf of the Virtual University of Pakistan, Ministry of Science and Technology and Mubashir Humayun, I welcome you to one of the final lectures in financial management. In this lecture, I'm going to introduce to you a very important and vast area in financial management that is known as international finance or multinational finance. Although multinational finance can take as many as 45 lectures, studying the subject by itself, we will try to cover the important points in just one lecture. So in this lecture, I will cover three areas within international finance. The first one will be multinational finance, that is related to multinational and transnational companies. The second part will be related to the impact of global markets and international finance on the areas of financial management that we have been talking about, namely the capital budgeting, capital structure, and also the capital asset pricing model. And then finally, in the third part of this lecture, we will talk about the most important aspect of international finance, which is foreign exchange, or FX. So now let's take a look at the first slide to introduce you to the issues related to international finance. If you take a look at the slide, then you will read that finance has become international, and in fact all of finance is international. Why? Because financial and capital markets are linked, and there's a very, very famous effect called the butterfly effect, which explains to us the impact of the linkages between the capital markets all over the world. So what is this butterfly effect? This butterfly effect is basically telling us that if a butterfly flaps its wings somewhere in South America, then the ripples that the wings create in the wind will have an impact on the other side of the globe, in the Pacific Ocean, even in Hawaii. Now, this is a geological and meteorological scientific phenomena. But this has been used to explain the impact of the stock market in the United States on the stock market in Tokyo, and the stock market in Singapore, and the stock markets in London and Luxembourg, and so on. In other words, because of the globalization, because of the international trade, because of the international flow of money and capital between countries all over the world, the markets and the financial markets, including the capital and the money markets, have become linked. So that is the butterfly effect, that changes in one market of one country have an impact on a different market in an entirely different country thousands of miles away. Now, the other thing that's important to realize is that no firm nowadays, even a firm that is entirely 100% domestic, in other words, a firm that buys raw materials locally and has only one manufacturing outlet in one country and only makes sales domestically in the same country to local buyers, even a company like that is affected by international finance. Why? Because let's suppose that this local manufacturer is making ice cream. How is he affected by the international finance? Quite simply, because Pakistan is importing ice cream. We import ice cream, European ice cream, and American ice cream. We also have international ice cream franchises over here. So, this local manufacturer of ice cream is affected by the international competition, by the imported ice cream, by the changes in the foreign exchange rate, because that has an impact on the price of imported ice cream, and that has an impact on his competition and his own sales and his own revenues. So even domestic producers and vendors are affected by international finance. I'd like to draw your attention to the slide, and let's take a look at two fundamental flows that affect foreign exchange rates, and that affect international finance. So if you take a look at the slide, you will see that the two fundamental trade flows that determine foreign exchange rates are, number one, the international flow or the trade of real goods, real assets, and number two, the second is the international flow of capital or money. Now, these are the two fundamental flows that are responsible fundamentally for changes in the foreign exchange rate, and also, as a matter of fact, the changes in the balance of payments of a country. Balance of payments of a country, if you take a look at the State Bank annual report or any macroeconomic book, will tell you that balance of payment covers all of the inflow and the outflow of real goods and capital that is taking place into and out of any country. So fundamentally, things are driven by these two factors. The flow of real goods. What do we mean by real goods? Real goods are cotton, sugar, paper, ice cream, pencils, pens, mobile phones. These are real goods. The flow, the import and the export of real goods has an effect on the balance of payment of a country and on the foreign exchange level of the country. And at the same time, now this flow in the real goods affects what's known as the current account balance in macroeconomics and in balance of payment analysis. The second flow, which is the flow of capital or the flow of money into and out of the country in the form of investment coming into the country and investment leaving the country. Investment coming in is often called foreign direct investment. That is investment in projects and infrastructural works in the country. The other kind of investment that comes into a country is known as portfolio investment. That is investment in the stock exchange, capital market and money markets of the country. So that is capital inflow coming into a country. Then of course there's capital outflow. Money flows out of a country when local businessmen decide to invest abroad, when they buy foreign T-bills, when they invest in foreign equities outside, or when the political situation of a country becomes so bad that the risk becomes very high and people decide to take their money out of the country. So that is capital inflow and outflow. And the biggest impact of all on these two flows has been that of technology and the internet. Because now, at the touch of a button, in a second, millions of dollars can be transferred into and out of Pakistan. So these two flows guide the balance of payment and the foreign exchange rates. Now let's talk about the reasons why multinational companies choose to invest in new projects in foreign countries. Why don't they just simply maintain all operations and all manufacturing units and all distribution units in one country? Why? Because there are certain advantages to setting up decentralized operations in various parts of the world, in different countries. And let's take a look at some of these reasons on the slide. So, why do multinationals do business internationally? If you take a look at the slide, you will see that one of the first reasons why multinationals choose to operate internationally is to expand market share. And, for example, why do companies in various countries around the world want to have a presence in the United States and Europe? Why? Because each of these economies is about $10 trillion in size. And that is a huge measure of the productive capacity and the buying power of these two regions. And each of these economies also has about 300 million consumers with a high per capita income exceeding $15,000 per person per year. So there's also a purchasing power in these regions of the world. Another reason why businesses choose to operate internationally is to get closer to the end user and to the customers. So another logical reason for businesses choosing to operate internationally around the world is for them to get closer to the end user and buyer. For example, if you take a classic case of Japanese automobile manufacturers such as Toyota, well, instead of just exporting cars from Japan to the United States, they have decided to set up entire factories and manufacturing units inside the United States. Why? Well, one of the reasons is because the United States is a very, very large car buyer's market, and they want to get closer to the end user or to the buyer of the cars. Why? Because then they have first-hand contact and feedback from the customers regarding any quality issues. There is also less lead time for delivery of the car to the consumer or to the buyer. They can provide better service and support directly. And, of course, as we will talk about later, one of the major reasons for firms to operate internationally is to avoid tariffs and import barriers. In fact, firms will often choose to shift operations or to add another operation in a different country in order to get around the legal issues connected with import barriers and customs duties. For example, the United States has placed quota on the import of textiles into the United States. In other words, they have restricted the quantity of textile goods, including cotton-based textiles, that can be imported into the United States in any given years. So that limit is set for various quantities. For example, for fabric, it is given in terms of square meters. For towels, it is given in terms of pounds or kilograms. And each country has been given a certain amount of quota which they can export to the United States. So Pakistan also has a limited quota of each textile item that they can export to the United States every year. Now, in order to legally get around this problem, many businessmen have decided to set up operations, textile units, in other countries, including Sri Lanka or the United Arab Emirates, or in some cases even in Mexico. Why? Because the quota level in these other countries is underutilized or is much higher. So it is much easier and cheaper for them to export the textile goods from another country. So this is another reason to operate internationally, is to get around trade barriers. So if you take a look at the slide, you will see that different laws related to business, whether it is contract law, property law, companies law, laws related to the capital flow, also taxation structures in different countries are different, and the level of involvement and interference by the government in different countries varies. And finally, of course, the level of development or the maturity of the different financial markets in different countries varies. For example, if you take a look at Saudi Arabia, in Saudi Arabia, the buying and selling of property for foreigners is restricted. So property rights and property law in Saudi Arabia is quite restrictive. Also, the equity market in Saudi Arabia is less developed than equity markets in many of the more developed Western countries. But if you take a look at the United States, well, in the United States, one can argue that the level of government interference is very, very high. The U.S. government interferes if it sees the possibility of a monopoly arising. So the monopoly laws in the United States are very, very strict. Also, taxation laws in the United States, corporate taxes, are quite severe and quite high. But if you compare the United States to the Bahamas, well, in the Bahamas, which is in the Caribbean, there are very, very low taxes, and the business laws are quite lenient. If you compare these countries to Saudi Arabia, well, it is very easy for foreigners to buy property in the United States, but it is not at all easy for foreigners to buy property in Saudi Arabia. Finally, if you take a look at the case of Japan, well, the Ministry of the Trade greatly supports the Japanese exporters abroad. So you find the Japanese government greatly assisting Japanese businesses that are doing business abroad. So these are some of the examples of the difference in government involvement, difference in taxes and taxation, and also the difference in the business laws in various countries that create differences in the kind of cash flows and the kind of risks that different businesses face in different countries. Finally, I would like to mention a very important area, an issue that affects international business, and that is that of different cultures. Businesses that operate internationally face countries and face buyers and suppliers of different countries who are from different cultures. And it's very important for firms to understand and to respect different cultures. Different countries and different cultures have different norms of behavior, different standards of ethics and morality, and they also have different standards for quality and different standards of customer awareness, or how well informed the average consumer or customers are in any country. So, for example, if we talk about Japan, in Japan, businesses are organized in what is known as keiretsus. And keiretsus are partnerships of banks with businesses. So in Japan, you find that the average company has a much higher level of debt in its capital structure than in USA. Why? Because large Japanese businesses, such as the consumer electronic companies you are familiar with, Mitsubishi and Sanyo, Sony, these companies are affiliated with banks in Japan. And it is oftentimes a lot easier for them to get loans because the bank has very, very accurate and good information about these companies, and it is much easier for them to lend money. Taking a look at South Korea, businesses are organized in what is known as K-balls or chaebols. And these are basically organizations in which the businesses have formed conglomerates. So oftentimes, large businesses in South Korea are not just operating in one industry, but in various different industries. If you take a look at the Gold Star Group, the Lucky Gold Star Group of South Korea, it began with textiles and real estate, and then it expanded to capital goods, equipment and machinery, and it also expanded into consumer electronics that we see in Pakistan. So you find these conglomerates or kaibols operating in South Korea. Now we can also talk about differences in consumer awareness or the level of consumer knowledge about different products and services and about their rights as buyers. So, for example, in Germany and in Switzerland, the level of consumer awareness is very high, and also their standards for quality are very high. Similarly, the standards for quality in Japan are quite high. You will find that consumers in developing countries, perhaps in South Asia, Africa, and South America, have lower quality standards, and that is linked to the level of education, the level of information, and so on. Also, the standards for ethics and morality does vary in different cultures. There are companies and rating agencies that measure the level of ethics or the level of corruption in different countries. And I won't mention the most corrupt countries in the world, but I will mention that countries such as Switzerland and Singapore rate very, very high in terms of the business ethics and the low amount of corruption in these countries. Finally then, you should also realize that the business culture varies in different countries because they are in different stages of development. So if you take a look at the way business is done in some of the Central African republics and the way business is done in Central Asia in the newly independent CIS countries, then oftentimes you have to rely on barter trade in these countries because the money economy has not permeated throughout the country. So in these countries you find businessmen getting paid not in terms of currency notes but perhaps in terms of real goods. So if a Pakistani goes to Central Asia and sells textile products, maybe he gets paid back in terms of goats or sheep. So that is the principle of the barter economy. Now let's talk about the second area I wish to discuss in this lecture related to international finance, and that is connecting international finance to the major areas that we have covered in this course on financial management. So we are interested in finding out what the impact of doing international business and what the impact of global markets is on diversification, risk and return, capital structure, capital budgeting, financial accounting, and so on. So let's take a look at the slide and go over the first important area, which is the impact of global markets on the diversification and risk. If you take a look at the slide, you will see that international diversification has value. Two gentlemen by the name of Bruno and Solnik did empirical research, and they found out that international portfolios of, let's say, 20 stocks have half as much risk as the same portfolio containing stocks of just one country. In fact, they mentioned that a portfolio of 20 stocks generally reduces the level of risk by 4 times compared to the average stock if you're talking about one country. But if you're talking about international investment, then investing in 20 different stocks will bring the total level of risk down by 8 times. So definitely there is a benefit attached to an international portfolio of stocks. Now let's talk about the impact of global markets on the capital asset pricing model and the security market line and the capital market line that we spoke about when we were studying risk and return. And the important thing to keep in mind is that you will recall we mentioned that the required rate of return on equity is equal to the risk-free rate of return plus the risk premium multiplied by the beta. Now, the risk premium in a single market or a segmented market, you will recall, was defined as RM minus R sub RF, where RM is the market rate of return and R sub RF is the risk-free rate of return. However, when we are talking about the world market or the global market, then we are talking about investors all over the world. And we have to take into account the required rate of return for these rational investors all over the world. So our market rate of return, RM, must be replaced by the world rate of return, or RW. So the equation then becomes that the required rate of return, R sub E, is equal to R sub RF plus RW minus R sub RF, that is the risk premium for global investment, multiplied by the beta for the investment. Now, the important thing to keep in mind is that in this model, we have to make a distinction between one case, which is that of segmented markets or individual markets that have their own market return, individual market return, and each market having its own capital market line, and each individual market having its own security market line and its own interest rate and discount rate. And the other model is to take a very, very global view and say to yourself that, well, all of these markets are connected and capital and goods are flowing from one market to the other and they're all interlinked. And therefore, then in this second model, you would pick RW, the world rate of return, instead of the market rate of return. The important consequence of this is that you will recall we spoke about the capital market line. And we mentioned that all possible efficient portfolios and stocks must lie on the capital market line. And that same capital market line became the security market line on the risk return graph. When you are talking about efficient portfolios and when you are talking about risk represented in the form of beta. And we mentioned that in efficient markets with rational investors, all efficient portfolios and stocks must lie on the line, on the security market line, on the capital market line. But that was for the case of one country. That was the case of the segmented view, where one country is a closed economy and it's not possible to invest abroad. However, when you are taking international investments into account, and when your investors can invest their money in whichever country is offering the best rate of return, then it is possible for an international investor to get a rate of return that is higher than the security market line, and a rate of return that is higher than the capital market line. So the line for the international investor is shifted up. For any value of risk or beta, he can get a higher return. Now, this is the case for international investors who are investing in a market where most of the investors are just investing domestically. Because the risk and return profile for an international investor is better than the risk return profile for investors who are just investing in the local market. Ultimately, the most rational and intelligent investor will be investing internationally, and he will be investing in the country and in the project or investment that is yielding the highest rate of return for a particular level of risk. So this is global optimization of risk and return. What this means is that when we spoke about the hook-shaped curve, when we were talking about risk and return, we spoke about the possibility where, because of diversification, it's possible to reduce risk and at the same time to increase return. We formed a hook-shaped curve, and we said that the optimal combination for a portfolio forms what is known as the efficient frontier. Now again, that was the efficient frontier for rational investors who were investing only in local, domestic, segmented markets. But if you have the case of an investor who has the option of investing internationally in better investments, then it is possible for him to have a risk return profile that is much better. In other words, for an international investor, his efficient frontier would be shifted up. For the same level of risk, he can attain a higher return. That's another important aspect of international investment to keep in mind. Now, let's talk about the impact of international finance on corporate financing. In other words, when companies are raising debt and equity, is there an advantage to international finance? Well, certainly, because companies, the objective of firms and companies is to raise debt and equity capital at the lowest possible cost. Remember, companies are trying to minimize the weighted average cost of capital. And the weighted average cost of capital is comprised of the cost of debt and the cost of equity. Debt being bonds, equity being shares. So, naturally, if a firm can raise debt and equity cheaper internationally from another country, then that firm will save money. And this is exactly what happens. For example, it's possible for Pakistani businesses to raise equity capital in Europe. Pakistani companies can list themselves on the Luxembourg Stock Exchange, and they can raise money in the form of euros. Similarly, Pakistani firms can list themselves on the NASDAQ American Stock Exchange in the form of the ADRs, American Depositary Receipts. So, Pakistani firms can then raise equity capital in America in the form of US dollars. Similarly, there is a, just like this market is called the Euro equity market, there is a Euro bond market. And this Euro bond market allows you to float your bonds in a currency of a different denomination. Now let's talk about the next area. That is the impact of international finance on capital budgeting. You will recall that the most important criteria that we spoke about in capital budgeting was NPV, net present value. And net present value is basically the sum of the future discounted cash flows. So there are two important variables. One, the forecasting of cash flows, and number two, the discount rate. Now, in the case of firms that are investing internationally, the calculation of the incremental net after-tax cash flows that we have been talking about so far is complicated by a few factors. Number one, different countries restrict the flow of capital in and out of the country. That means that multinational companies operating in some countries have to keep the profits and the cash flows and the income in that country where they're investing. They're not allowed to take out all of the money. There are restrictions on repatriating their money back out of the country. That's one problem. The second issue is related to the transfer pricing, the impact of royalties, and of course the impact of the rate of inflation in the country where they're investing or where they have a subsidiary company. And all of these affect the calculation of the net after-tax incremental cash flow. The other thing we have to take into consideration is the discount rate. Now, the discount rate, keep in mind, is basically the required rate of return or the weighted average cost of capital for the firm. And if we are talking about a multinational company that is receiving cash flows in a foreign country, in a foreign currency, then what discount rate should we pick? Well, generally speaking, you should pick the discount rate for the foreign currency in which you are generating the foreign cash flows. And you should calculate the NPV using the cash flows in the foreign currency and using the discount rate for the foreign country and for the foreign currency, calculate the net present value in the foreign currency, and then convert it into your own currency where your head office is located at the present spot foreign exchange rate, which we'll talk about in a minute. Finally, let me mention to you the impact of international investments and foreign investments on financial accounting. And very briefly speaking, when we're talking about the profit and loss or income statement, then if these revenues and expenses have been taking place over a period of 1 year, which is the accounting period, then if you need to convert the foreign currency expenses and revenues into your home currency, then pick the average foreign exchange rate that was prevailing during the accounting period. That is the case for the profit and loss statement. But when you're talking about the balance sheet, and when you're talking about fixed non-financial assets like property and inventory and stock, so on, then you need to pick the foreign exchange rate at the time that the fixed asset was purchased. This is for non-financial fixed assets. You pick the foreign exchange rate at the time of the historical cost. That's the basis you pick. But when you're talking about financial fixed assets, then you follow the rule that you use for the income statement, which is for financial assets, you pick the average foreign exchange rate during the time of investment. Now let me talk about the third and final area we'll study in international finance, and that is a very, very important area of foreign exchange. Now, foreign exchange basically is talking about currencies, and every country prints its own distinctive currency notes. And the printing of these notes and the supply of these notes into the economy is regulated by the central banks, which determine the monetary policy of the country. Now, it used to be that the currency notes of the important currencies around the world were backed by gold. And that system remained until 1971, and it was called Bretton Woods. Until that time, the major currencies were linked to the US dollar, and the US dollar was backed by, every US dollar was backed by a certain amount of gold. But after 1971, that ended, and countries basically began the flexible exchange rate system, managed and free floats, which I won't go into in detail. Keep in mind that the value of the currency is fundamentally determined by the flow of real goods into and out of the country, the import and exports, as well as the flow of capital into and out of the country. The inflow of capital in the form of investment and the outflow of capital from the country. And at the same time, there are financial markets for foreign exchange that are known as FX or foreign exchange markets. And these are some of the largest markets in the world, with trading of trillions of dollars taking place every day. These markets are in some ways virtual markets. They're electronic markets. They're not necessarily physical buildings where the buying and selling of currencies takes place, although there are money changers all over the world. We have money changers in Pakistan. We have banks that change currency notes. But most of this trading is taking place between banks and companies over the computer and over the internet. So there is a tremendous volume of trading that takes place, and there are basically three major kinds of foreign exchange markets. The first one is known as the spot market. And in the spot market, we're talking about the negotiation and the buying and selling of different currencies at the current price or the spot price. And we define the spot or current period as being from now until 2 days. Why 2 days? Because it takes 2 days to transfer money from one country to the other. This is one kind of market. The second kind of foreign exchange market is known as the forwards market. And the forward market, as the name suggests, is when buyers and sellers negotiate the trading of a currency that is to take place at a certain point in future. And that point in future is beyond 2 days. It can be 1 week, 1 month, 6 months, 1 year ahead. So you settle right now and you sign an agreement that at some point in the future, after 1 year, let's say, I will buy $1 million from so-and-so person at the rate of 60 rupees per dollar. That is a forward contract. Forward contracts are privately negotiated between parties and between banks. Now let's talk about the third kind of foreign exchange market, and that is the futures market. The futures market for foreign exchange is a derivatives market. It's called derivatives because the value of the future is derived from the forward exchange rate. And it is adjusted by something that is known as the mark-to-market risk premium. And I won't go into that in detail either, but basically, for futures trading, people and investors who are interested in buying and selling currency futures have to maintain a trading or margin account with a foreign exchange broker. And every day, depending on the profit and loss position of their investment, they need to maintain a minimum cash balance in their account. Futures are different from forwards because futures basically are standardized in terms of the value of the contract. So the value of the futures contract might be fixed at $125,000, let's suppose. And also the dates of maturity of futures contracts are also fixed at a certain time during the year. And that can be 4 times during the year for commodities, and it can be every month in the case of some other assets. So that is the case of the futures foreign exchange market. And at the same time, there is another market which is known as the options foreign exchange market. And I should just mention over here that options are a very, very important kind of derivative security. Their value is derived either from the spot price, in the case of the spot option, or from the futures price. And that is called the futures option. And an option is, as the name suggests, not an obligation. When you buy an option to buy a house, you have the option of not buying it or buying it. But you pay a certain small price to buy the option of buying the house. And that small price you pay for buying the option is naturally much less than the price of the house. That's why this has become a very, very popular market. And within options trading, there are a few terms that you should be familiar with. The call option is the right to buy something at a certain strike price in the future, at a fixed date in the future, or until a fixed date in the future. The put option is the right to sell something at a fixed strike price by a certain date in the future. So you should be familiar with these terms and options, and also something that we did not have time to go into in this course, but that is a very important area of options valuation. Just like we studied the valuation of stocks and bonds, you can also value options, and they're valued using either the binomial model or the very, very famous Black and Scholes model. Now, there are some relationships between the foreign exchange rates, interest rates, and inflation that I'd like you to be familiar with. And let's take a look at the slide and familiarize ourselves with 3 basic relationships. The purchasing power parity, PPP, the Fisher effect, and the IRP, interest rate parity. These are 3 relationships that help you to understand how you can calculate the spot and the forward exchange rates and link them to the interest rates and the inflations in the 2 countries whose foreign exchange rates you are measuring. So let's take a look at the slide. On the slide, you will find that the first point is regarding the spot foreign exchange rate between 2 countries, and it can be determined by the price of the real goods, real physical goods in the 2 countries. This is known as the purchasing power parity theorem, and you will see that I have shown that the spot price of rupees to dollars is equal to the price of the good in Pakistan divided by the price of the good in USA. So, for example, if we're talking about the price of Levi's jeans that are made both in Pakistan and USA, then if the price of Levi's 501 is $50 in America and 3,100 rupees in Pakistan, then you can estimate the spot foreign exchange rate, S rupees to US dollars, is equal to 3,100 rupees divided by $50, and that is equal to 62 rupees to $1. And this is very close to the actual spot foreign exchange rate, which is about 60 rupees these days. The next relationship is called the Fisher effect, and it links the nominal interest rate to the expected inflation, which is the fundamental macroeconomic variable. And over here you'll see that the 1 plus the interest rate in rupees divided by 1 plus the interest rate in US dollars is equal to 1 plus the inflation rate in Pakistan divided by 1 plus the inflation rate in USA. And here you would write the percent values for inflation and interest rate in decimal form. So please note that you can use the Fisher effect to estimate the interest rate in one country based on the inflation rates in the 2 countries. Finally then, we will take a look at the IRP, or the interest rate parity theorem, and this allows you to estimate the forward currency rate if you know the spot rate and the relative interest rates in the 2 countries. So the forward rate of rupees to US dollars divided by the spot rate of rupees to US dollars is equal to 1 plus the interest rate in rupees divided by 1 plus the interest rate in US dollars. And so I've shown an example whereby you can use the IRP to estimate the forward exchange rate of rupees to US dollars after 1 year from now. Using the yield curves, you can find out that the interest rate on 1 year maturity bonds in Pakistan is 10% and in USA it's 2%. So you know that the current or spot foreign exchange rate is 60 rupees to the dollar. So after 1 year, the forward rate, F, will be equal to the spot rate of rupees to dollars multiplied by 1 plus the interest rate in rupees divided by 1 plus the interest rate in US dollars. That's equal to 60 multiplied by 1.1 divided by 1.02, and that's equal to 64.7 rupees to the dollar. In other words, we've been able to forecast that the forward foreign exchange rate after 1 year will be 64.7 rupees to the dollar. Finally then, in closing, let me just mention that foreign exchange rates can be quoted in newspapers from the point of view of the bank or the money changer in either the European Convention or the American Convention. And generally, in Pakistan, we follow the European Convention, which means that the currency is, the local currency is written in the numerator and the foreign currency is in the denominator. So if you take a look at the slide, we'll go through a simple example to explain what it means when the money changer says US dollars 60, 61. Taking a look at the slide, I've explained that when the money changers say US dollars 60, 61, it means that his bid rate is 60 rupees to the dollar and his ask rate is 61 rupees to the dollar. And the bid rate, which is the buying price of the currency, of 60 rupees to the dollar means that the bank or the money changer will buy one US dollar from you for 60 rupees. And it also means that you, the customer, are selling the dollar to the bank. The ask rate of 61 rupees means that the bank or the money changer will sell or ask $1 to you for 61 rupees. And this also means that you as the customer are buying the dollar from the bank. And this is would be the case if, for example, you're traveling abroad to the USA. Finally, if you take a look at the slide, you will see that it's possible to calculate what is known as cross rates using the transitivity. For example, suppose you want to convert euros directly into US dollars, but you are in Pakistan, then you need to estimate the euro to the US dollar foreign exchange rate, but the money changers and banks only quote the rates in terms of US rupees. So this is not a problem because we know that there are 60 rupees in $1 and 55 rupees to a euro. Therefore, the spot US dollar to euro rate is equal to the US dollar to rupee rate multiplied by the rupee to euro rate. That is equal to 1 US dollar divided by 60 rupees multiplied by 55 rupees divided by 1 euro, which is equal to 0.9167 US dollars per euro. We have covered a lot of international finance in this one little lecture. In fact, international finance, as I mentioned, can be studied over an entire term, and in fact, there are students who have been studying it all their lives. With this, I would like to close the material regarding international finance. You can refer to one of the end chapters in Brigham and Kapensky, 8th edition, and kindly also go over my slides in detail, as I'm sure you'll find it an excellent review, and for those of you who want to study it further, an excellent starting point to continue your education. With this, I would like to thank you on behalf of the Virtual University of Pakistan, Ministry of Science and Technology, and Mubashir Humayun. Bahut bahut shukriya, khuda hafiz, aur assalamu alaikum.